All right. Hello, everyone. This is our panel on Title II and net neutrality. This is a very packed panel, which is a good thing. I think probably what we're going to do is just go through and do some introductions and then talk a little bit about the background of net neutrality, sort of what it means. I'll talk a little bit about Title II and what exactly that means for the non-lawyers in the audience, and even for the lawyers, because it's a super wonky area of the law. And then we'll open it up for questions. Since this is kind of a hot topic, we figured, you know, there might be some more questions floating around, so we'll leave some time for that. So if you want to start, TJ, with the intro?
Sure. My name is TJ Myhill. I'm an attorney here in Atlanta, Georgia. I work in intellectual property and technology issues, and I primarily handle litigation, but we do some transactional work as well. So I'm kind of here to talk about how when things go wrong. But
I'm Meredith Rose. I am a staff attorney at Public Knowledge. We were really involved in the fight to get net neutrality to happen. So I work a lot in telecom and also copyright stuff. So that's my background.
I'm Gordon Hall. For the last 2 years, I've been working in the cryptocurrency space for BitPay. Was previously leading their engineering team, so I'm really interested in mesh networking and how that can affect net neutrality in the future.
Can you turn it up just a bit? We can hear it back. I'm Kit Walsh. Can you hear me in the back? Great. I'm Kit Walsh. I'm a staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We've also been involved in the fight to get net neutrality. We have some skepticism about the FCC, and so we've been involved in a way that makes sure that they adopt bright line rules that will stand up in court and are legally defensible. And we're really proud of the huge victory that was helped along by 4 million people calling in, pressuring the FCC to adopt net neutrality rules that would stand up. I've also been involved in some alternative efforts that try to get at some of the same problems as net neutrality through competition. So encouraging states and municipalities to invest in infrastructure that then companies can offer internet service over, so you get actual competition in that last mile internet access service.
Great. So we'll just start off with a little bit of history about net neutrality. How many of you have run into the phrase Title II when you're like reading about this? Okay, yeah, so it's the other show of hands. How many of you actually know what Title II is? Smaller, but pretty overlapping Venn diagram. Okay, so rewind to the days when we only had a copper-based telephone system. This is back in the days when we had functionally a telephone monopoly. The FCC was created, and the Major Telecommunications Act was 1936, basically. And that gave birth to the FCC. They were given the power to regulate this telephone system because we looked at this and said, you know, this is really important. We want to make sure this gets rolled out to every part of the country. And they were given the authority to do a whole bunch of different stuff to it, basically. They could do everything from reward. They have a thing called universal service where they can basically give, they have a pot of money that they can use to subsidize building out phone networks to really rural or hard to reach areas, all the way up to things like quality regulation, rate regulation, which is sort of the bogeyman phrase that gets thrown around. Fast forward to 1996. By now we have not only the telephone network, but we have a lot of people who have looked at the telephone network and thought, I can plug something into that and do something kind of cool with it. So you have fax systems, you have all these alternate data transmission services, and this is really true like in the 80s especially. They start coming up with some stuff that sounds pretty crazy nowadays. There was a project at one point, and it actually worked, and it ran. It was a commercial service that transmitted data from Chicago to St. Louis on microwaves. This was a thing that happened. It didn't last very long. But essentially you had all these non-telephone services that ran over the telephone network. And so what the FCC was doing is they're looking at this and they're going, well, this stuff isn't telephone, really. This is something else. This is an information service. And so we had, you know, so we don't really want to, like, but at this point, they didn't really have the regulatory structure to figure out what to do with these, and it was kind of a very awkward place. In the 1996 Act, they established basically two categories of things. Congress sat down, and they actually did something moderately intelligent, and they had Title I and Title II. Title I was for these information services, all this newfangled stuff that was plugging into the phone line but wasn't telephone service. Title II was for telephone service. But it was also for all major communications networks. It was for telecommunications services. which is the technical definition in the statute. Now, it didn't say phone service. It just said telecommunication service. Basically, what happens is under Title II, you have things like the traditional telephone network. That gives the FCC a lot of power to go in and, like I said earlier, do things like minimum quality standards. They can mandate interconnection, which means like, you know, like if Gordon has a big trunk of fiber that I want to get into and I say, like, I'm a tiny provider, there are certain restrictions about how I can go up to him and go, I want to interconnect with you. And under Title II, he has to say, all right. And to some extent, the FCC can sort of regulate what the terms of those agreements are. Title I services were kind of an essentially, Title I gave very little authority to the FCC to do anything. They were granted the right to do things under what they call ancillary authority, which is basically, well, it plugs into the phone service, so we have the right to deal with it because we want to prevent it from degrading phone service. And essentially, this has been going on, and they kicked the can on classifying broadband internet service for a long time. You know, they just kept putting it off, and they said, well, it's kind of an information service because it's kind of not like a telephone, but it sometimes plugs into the telephone network, and we don't really know what we want to do, and the ISPs are hugely well-funded and powerful and very present at the FCC, and so they fought the concept of being a Title II service tooth and nail because they didn't want to have the FCC, they didn't want to give this FCC the toolbox to potentially regulate them. In the way that they were afraid of. And essentially, finally, the FCC, after many, many years of like wailing and gnashing of teeth and just constant fights at the office, basically finally said, fine, we're going to do it. And they reclassified broadband internet as Title II. So it's a telecommunication service. And now what this does is this gives them a toolbox. It doesn't automatically set in things like rate regulation or quality minimums. All it does is give the FCC the authority to theoretically put this stuff in place. But when they reclassified, they explicitly went on the record and said, we're not going to rate regulate. We're not going to do all of... Basically, they went through and took like the top 10 worries of ISPs and said, like, look, we're not interested in rate regulating because that's just... it's going to be a headache for everyone. But they now have the authority to do all of this other stuff, things like no blocking, no throttling of ISP traffic. You know, there was a big to-do with Netflix on Comcast about a year or two ago now, I don't recall, where essentially Comcast was throttling Netflix. Some of you may have been on the receiving end of this, I was. And essentially they were going like, well, you're taking up too much bandwidth. And everyone else is saying, you have fiber trunks. You basically have unlimited bandwidth. This is lies. And so what they did was they essentially throttled Netflix just enough so that it would degrade the user experience, but not be eminently obvious to regulators what they were doing. And so now the FCC actually has the toolkit to do things to prevent that kind of bad behavior. So that's what Title II comes from, and that's what it is. So when we talk about net neutrality, people like to talk about rate regulation, regulating it like a utility. That's not the same thing. All it is it's giving the FCC a toolkit to manage, to make sure like that end consumers and content creators on the other end of those networks, like, you know, all the way from, you know, YouTube's and Google's down to my mom with her legacy GeoCities page, which I think finally got folded like a year ago. You know, all of these people are, it's both ends of the equation that are protected. There's a lot of gatekeeper power that ISPs have. And so now the FCC actually has a position in the market where there's a clear regulatory framework and they can deal with it and they can make sure this kind of bad behavior doesn't happen. So.
Just to make sure we're all on the same page, everyone here is against net neutrality, right?
Is anyone on this panel against net neutrality? All right.
I wouldn't say that I'm against net neutrality, but I would say that deferring the authority to regulate the internet from the corporations to a government institution is still problematic, and we can talk a little bit about that later if anybody else feels the same way.
That's actually the best argument I think they made all along. I mean, it was a terrible argument in the long run because you're obviously not regulating yourself, but the idea that putting this out as a utility and creating more federal regulations and more government oversight and more government involvement in the internet is a bad idea. And I don't necessarily disagree with that, but I don't think Comcast did itself any favors. So when it's down to Comcast gets to do whatever it wants or the government has to have some oversight, even I might break down and say there's some government oversight.
Yeah, and that's part of the thing is it's a very easy rhetorical tool to say, like, regulation bad, government regulation bad, free market good.
Yeah, but all I like hail clean the free market. Water, too.
I went to UChicago Law School. I heard a lot of this. all hail the free market. But, I mean, yeah, so there's an easy rhetorical tool to put out there. Having said that, I mean, if you look at things like Comcast, Comcast is essentially the nightmare scenario for everything in every hypothetical. because chances are they've done it. And, you know, when they bought NBC Universal, there was this big concern about, you know, and there's a whole other argument to be had on the DOJ and their merger review. And DOJ basically said, well, don't do bad things. And then Comcast said, okay. And then turned around and did bad things because the DOJ didn't ever bother following up and they had no teeth on that merger. But essentially, you know, you've got these companies. So think about it. You've got a content creator and potentially a content distributor. Like, you know, there's a YouTuber and then a YouTube. I use this. YouTube might be a bad example because it's a big company, so we're a little less sympathetic to them. But, you know, just imagine we had Meredith Tube, you know, and Gordon has a channel on Meredith Tube, and I, tiny Meredith Tube, am trying to put this out into the universe, and I need to reach end consumer on the opposite end of there. I have to reach my husband Garrett, who's in the back here somewhere. I don't know where he is. He's not paying attention. Yeah, I see him. I see you. So he's all the way back there, which means I've got to get like. I got to take Gordon's data and I got to like shunt it down and I've got to like hand it back through the crowd and make sure, and you guys are all in business together, got to make sure that you're handing it all the way back. Now, if I bought Gordon and said like, oh, look, I now also own all the content creator, and TJ comes along and says, hey, I've also got like a video channel. I can go, no, I own the tube and you're not getting on it unless you pay me money. And this is what you had things with Netflix. You know, you've got a lot of it's vertical integration, essentially, from an antitrust perspective. If you've got a company that not only owns the means of distribution, but also owns the things that are being distributed, you've got a real problem. If you're a competitor on any of those fronts, and if you're a consumer. So, you know, no one really wins in those scenarios except Comcast. And that was an argument that Comcast's response to that was, we'd have to be crazy to throttle Netflix, and then they throttle Netflix. So you saw how far that one went.
Yeah, and we certainly didn't get involved because we're excited to see you know, the FCC acting, but the ISPs are in a position of incredible power over their subscribers and over people who are trying to communicate over the internet. So this is an instance where government intervention is needed to prevent an abuse of private power that would be really harmful for our free speech, our freedom of association, our public discourse, and also innovation. So people who want to become the next YouTube but can't yet afford to pay the tolls that ISPs would demand to create a high quality connection to end users. So throughout the process, we proposed when Meredith mentioned that the FCC promised not to exert certain powers, that was something that we proposed as part of the bargain for Title II reclassification. And we also have supported Title II reclassification because it provides a very clear and cabined legal authority for the FCC to act. Mm-hmm. The previous open internet order was enacted under an authority that doesn't have the same clear limitations. And so if the FCC is going to do net neutrality, we want their authorities to be clear and we want the requirements to be clear. And then we want it to stand up in court. Mm-hmm.
Jeff, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hey, sorry for being late, folks. I got caught up in the Marriott Hyatt, and then I had to help some folk who were lost along the way. My name is Jeff Termeshazen. I have degrees in political science, MIS in cybersecurity. I work as a technical consultant for a payments company called ACI Worldwide, and I apologize for being late.
It's all good.
Well, you know, the reality is there's not a lot of debate to be had. We can talk about the specifics and facts and go on more about what net neutrality is and what the new FCC rules are and things like that. But there are a lot of people in here, and I think this probably functions better as a discussion. So let's maybe start throwing the box around
and
see who wants to chime in.
I can talk smack about Comcast some more. That's like my job.
Speaking here?
Yes. Oh,
okay. Yep.
I was just wanting to talk about like mobile for a second. I know that's like the next area. I know there's a lot of talk about data caps. Do you see a time in the future perhaps where like say AT&T may say, if you pay us an extra $10 a month, we will not count, let's say, your Pandora usage towards your monthly data cap. And I think if you polled 100 people, they may not admit it publicly, but I think a lot of people would be willing to pay that. I know when I look at my data usage and how much Pandora I use every day, even though I hate myself for it because it really goes against my core principles of how the net should be run, when you have a cap, you got to be very careful with it. So if there was one thing that could be not going towards that cap, you might have to think about it. I just wonder your thoughts on the matter.
Okay, if anybody from AT&T is here, please don't think we're going to spend $10 extra.
So, well, the funny thing is that's actually already happened. That's happened with a couple of different carriers. I think Sprint?
T-Mobile.
With Rhapsody, yeah.
Yeah, T-Mobile and Rhapsody. Rhapsody is exempt from your data cap. So there's an interesting proceeding. It's actually going on right now. The FCC does this thing every year where it's called the 706 report. The state of the, it's some ungodly long name, but it's basically the broadband state of the union report. They do it every year. They're in the process of soliciting comments right now, and they're actually kind of changing up how they did it. So they used to simply take landline broadband connections. That was all they cared about because they looked at mobile and they said, like, this is kind of finicky. We've got this speed definition that we're using for landline. It doesn't really work with, like, no one's going to get 25 megabits per second on your cell phone. And if you do, I want to know who your carrier is because I want in. But, they basically said, all right, we'll just take care of this and then, like, we'll figure out if we want to expand it later. And now they're actually doing it, and they're saying, all right, well, we're going to start considering mobile, and we're going to say that an area only has access to advanced telecommunication services if it has both mobile and landline broadband, which is a big deal. And one of the things that they're thinking about when they're basically, if they take a look at mobile service and have to decide, does this count as broadband? And they're starting to take a look at things like latency and reliability. And they're also taking a look at data caps and data cap exemptions. So this is something that's actually going to start coming out of those reports in the near future.
And the sort of technical term that you may see as people discuss that is zero rating. So basically, if something does, it counts as zero towards your data cap, that's called zero rating. So you may see that term used. And it does certainly create another way that the ISP can distort users' enjoyment of content and selection of sources of information online. So it is also within the umbrella of net neutrality issues.
There was actually kind of a neat, sorry, I just wanted to bring this up because it's funny. Sprint essentially did we found out that Sprint, so there was a website where you could go to test your mobile speed. And they, if your phone had gone over its data cap and it was being throttled for speed, so they'd like purposely like lower your connection so you couldn't go any fast, they would throttle everything except for the speed rating website.
Clever.
Like, we actually caught them doing this, and they were like, what? and then they stopped, so.
Right, and Comcast is actually already starting to do with the whole data cap thing. Okay, before I get to my question, Comcast is actually starting to do the whole pay us and we won't cap your data anymore. Like, they just announced, pay us $30 and we won't cap your connection anymore. Mm-hmm. Are you guys working to fight this at all?
Well, I don't think of data caps inherently as a net neutrality issue. If you get, 500 megabytes of neutral bandwidth, then they're not treating different content in different ways or different devices differently. I don't see that as a net neutrality issue. So you can pay more for a faster connection. You can pay more for a higher data cap. It's really when they start to discriminate with respect to the applications, devices, speakers, content, that becomes a net neutrality issue that we're concerned about.
Yeah, that now just admitted that just purely offended.
Well, yeah, actually, I saw that tweet I think you're referring to where they asked the head of engineering at Comcast, what's with the data caps? And he said, I don't know, I'm not in charge of the business decisions. And everyone went, oh. So yeah, that is a thing that's...
But I mean that's less a question of net neutrality, more a question of monopoly. And when you've got this is where I get my internet from, then this was what my options are. I can buy the cheap internet or the fast internet.
That's good.
Having more competition might be great, but it's the reality of the world we live in.
Who in this room has only one choice for a broadband provider? Raise your hand. That sucks.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, yes, but that's the reality, and that's actually a little better than the national average.
Really?
Yeah.
I was wondering, I noticed a couple of carriers were testing this out probably last year. I know AT&T was testing out subsidized data usage as far as like taking advertisements and they would actually give you data or subsidize your data, something along that. Do you guys have any commentary on that and any updates on that? I think some of them discontinued testing. I'm not entirely sure. Do you guys have any comments on that situation?
Yeah, so I have heard of this. I haven't been following it terribly closely. Really sort of in that vein, and I guess it because they use targeted ads, so I guess it sort of ties in, is that there is a big debate going on right now about the value of privacy in it's called CPNI, Consumer Proprietary Network Information, which is essentially a fancy way of saying your metadata when you're browsing online. So if you think about like those of us who grew up having a copper landline phone in our homes, when you got your phone bill, it was a list of what number you were calling from, what number you were calling to, the time and the duration. And that was all the information that you got. And that was all essentially all routing information. They didn't know who was on either end of the phone. So they're not looking into the contents of your conversations. That's CPNI. And now that broadband is the Title II service, they have similar restrictions on how they can use analogous data. So basically like what IP address you're calling from, what IP address you're calling to, and the way they route your data. There's a lot of debate right now about the concept of pay for privacy, which is AT&T has, I believe, has announced that they're planning on trying, at the very least, I don't know if they've started it, a program where if you pay an extra N dollars per month, they will not track your CPNI, which arguably they have to do under the law. And so there's a big debate about, you know, people who want more affordable, who have, you know, like in dire economic straits, who really need broadband access. And the only way they're going to be able to afford it is if they don't, you know, they're willing to give up their privacy and they don't care as much because they just want a cell phone with broadband, versus people who say like, no, privacy is a right. And then, or is it a right or is it a good? And so there's a long debate about that going on right now. It's a lot of different groups are involved, like from telcos to civil rights to First Amendment groups, you know. And it's a complicated debate, but that is going on right now.
And not to interject on the next question, I just wanted to add on to that. Have you heard anything about, as far as considering, like, I know there was legality problems with, I think it was Verizon that was inserting something into web traffic request?
The super cookie.
We need it on a microphone.
I'm sorry.
I'll
repeat that. I'm sorry. Do you guys have any, you know, thing to say on how I think it was Verizon that was interjecting web traffic requests, and I don't remember if they ruled on the legality of that or not. I'm not entirely sure what was happening with that situation.
I think Verizon just stopped. Stopped on its own when it got caught.
We caught them and filed a complaint, but as far as I know, there hasn't been a ruling on that yet. The other place where these ad injection practices come into play in the net neutrality context is that sometimes the ISPs will use their position as your gateway to the internet to replace the ads on a website with their own ads and get the revenue from that. And that, like, censoring someone else's content, even if it's ads, to replace it with their own ads is that comes into the neutrality landscape.
Hi, I was wondering, when we talked about the toolbox, what kind of tools specifically does it give them to monitor? For example, I have Comcast, and at exactly 6 o'clock, there's no point in doing anything on the internet because everyone's going to be on it. And I had one choice of internet provider. I mean, I know there's property issues with how they lay the lines and to each apartment complex. What kind of tools can they maybe use to improve on that?
So some of the stuff they have, I mean, obviously the big one that everyone knows about is rate regulation. This all kind of comes out of their statutory mandate to make sure that telecommunication services are available at just and reasonable rates, I think is the quote. But they have to, I mean, so common things that actually, if anyone here is a super nerd like me and follows the FCC, they just had a ruling on a thing called the tech transition, which is essentially, well, companies are now ripping out the copper phone network that we were talking about earlier, and they're replacing it with fiber. And one of the things that they've got going on is it's a universal service mandate, which essentially says, like, you need to provide service to people if they ask for it. And then there's some caveats about, well, if they live at the top of Denali, then, like, maybe we'll figure something out. But, like, by and large, if a consumer says, I want phone service, they have to get it. And so now there's some debate about, like, well, if someone says, I want broadband, and it's, like, reasonably you're reasonably able to plug them into your broadband network, then, you know, they're still hashing out the details of how a lot of this works. One of the big things, actually, that we had to deal with was Section 221, which is, sorry, I'm like rifling through my brain here. It's essentially that if a phone company wanted to completely stop serving an area because they have this universal service mandate, if they wanted to stop serving the area, they're like, you know what, Middletown, New Jersey. No, we're just not going to give them phone service anymore. It's my hometown. If they said, you know what, no, we don't like these guys anymore. We just want to stop offering copper phone service. They had to go up to the FCC and go, by the way, we want to stop offering copper phone service. And then the FCC would have to go yay or nay, basically. If they were, you know, upgrading it to a different line, they just had to notify people. But there's this whole thing about like what happens when you either remove or replace service in an area with something else. And now broadband is under Title II. So they are subject to, they theoretically are subject to similar limitations. Now the FCC is still, like I said, they're hashing out how this is all gonna look. CPNI, like I said earlier, your proprietary network browsing information, that's gonna be, they're hashing that out, like how are they gonna deal with that? So this is all kind of in an early stage. But those are all tools that are theoretically in the toolkit.
And it also includes transparency requirements and the ability to require the network to disclose how they're going to manage and shape your traffic. And it's the basis for the Brightline net neutrality rules that ban discrimination on the basis of content and prevent site blocking. So if your connection is being throttled because you are using BitTorrent or because you're accessing a video service that competes with Comcast video service, then the processes that the FCC has created using its Title II authority allow you to initiate a complaint or would allow the FCC to initiate an investigation and then to punish the ISP for violating the rules.
Are you in an apartment complex or a house?
It's a complex.
I don't know, there's no reason to this over here. We had a satellite service and it was horrible. And it took about a year or so, but get your neighbors to go complain to the complex management. We and Comcast for, it is actually better than the SAT service, which was amazing. But they actually swapped out all the lines. So it's a lot easier on a complex level in some ways because you've almost got a captive audience of all your neighbors who are stuck on a bad line versus being a private house where it's pretty much just you complaining about the line. So if you want that change, see who else is out there. Do some of your own legwork. Take that, you know, to your neighbors and basically say, hey, you guys want to join me in this? Then go complain to the management. Because if they kick up enough of a fuss, then basically the company that's providing you now gets told, look, you either need to upgrade because our people are unhappy or we need to go with someone else. And in some cases, they'll upgrade. In some cases, they'll just swap out to a new thing.
I would just like to note that at 2:56 p.m., someone said something nice about Comcast.
Market.
That may be the only time that happens in this panel.
Time of death.
Okay. I know technically there are some services on phones, for instance, voice, that have to be prioritized in order to have good quality voice. Sorry, is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. So I know some services in the telecom industry have to be prioritized for quality purposes. For instance, voice has to be prioritized over data, because it has only a short period of time that it has to get there until that part of the conversation is passed. My question is, does the panel, generally speaking, want absolutely no prioritization of data, or is it specific to content from specific providers such as Netflix?
Well, I think the same thing applies. It depends on whether all data at every point is treated equally. As long as everybody is inferior to voice data, that's fine. But as long as everybody who's inferior to voice data in that next data level is treated the same, and if everybody in the next data level is treated the same, then you're fine. You can prioritize that I need to call 911 before I need to call my mom, and I should probably be able to call my mom before I watch Meredith Tube.
I'm going to regret that one.
Maybe a website by the end
of the day.
Somebody
buy the domain.
Someone get that domain.
That I think is perfectly fine from my perspective, at least. Maybe people disagree, but from my perspective, as long as you're treating equal data equally, then you're being neutral.
Yeah, so the rules have an allowance for reasonable network management, which includes things like maintaining the integrity of the network and sort of good faith management practices that aren't discrimination in disguise. So there's some allowance for necessary alterations. But one of the issues is that the ISPs can make a lot of money by creating artificial scarcity so that if you want your high bandwidth application to work, you pay them extra to make it work. And so one of the issues with Netflix was they degraded the connection to Netflix rather than installing or taking advantage of existing infrastructure that would have let them give customers what they were paying for. They, as a result of artificial scarcity, were able to make some money. So if you allow this kind of prioritization based on, well, my application requires a lot of bandwidth, so let me pay to get extra, then you're opening the door to encouraging that artificial scarcity and discouraging real investment in infrastructure that makes everything faster and opens the door to applications that no one has thought of yet.
Do you foresee the net neutrality debate going towards home servers having effect on that, about like carrier agreements not allowing servers from home, things like carrier grade NAT interfering with servers from home? Do you foresee that being part of the debate?
In some cases, absolutely. If you actually read through your contract now, unless you've got like say the business servers, something in your contract usually says that you cannot run a server at home. Now, they don't always enforce it particularly well, and you've got the downside where your connection is almost always DHCP versus static IP, which has changed over about the last 10, 15 years, because it used to be you could actually request a static IP from your ISP and they'd be happy to give it to you. But I know that I have run servers from home, and you pretty much just take the hit that comes with it. Now, they're not major servers, so you're not using them for business. They're entirely personal use, like gateway, email and things like that. But if you actually go through your contract, they can block those if it starts causing a problem. And that's not always a bad thing, because many spammers would run from their homes, and the companies need some way, simply because it's going to affect my service, to be able to block those things. So it really depends on what you're doing. If what you're doing doesn't take a whole lot of bandwidth, they're probably not going to care. If you're actually running a business or doing something that is high bandwidth from there, though, they'll probably come in and say, look, you're using a lot of data. You've either got to upgrade your service or you need to start throttling you, and here's why.
Yeah, I would think that if they sold you a bunch of neutral data to use for whatever application with whatever devices you want, and the device that you want to use is a server running server software, and then they start throttling or blocking, then that would seem to be a neutrality problem.
Well, but then you're right back to the same issue we talked about yesterday with what are you actually agreeing to in the licenses that you've signed and what right. you've actually bought from Comcast. So.
My question has to pertain to the universal service fee. Is ISPs now being part of Title II and tell them to collect that fee, and will they be, and likewise, will they be able to collect and use it to expand service in rural areas, improve equipment, or just treat it as any company would treat a subsidy, or is that just not applicable to ISPs right now?
So the Universal Service Fund, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, you may have noticed a line on your phone bill at the very bottom that will say Universal Service Fee. This is essentially the phone company's way of passive-aggressively letting you know that they had to pay the FCC some money that they then put in a pot and then redistribute back to the phone companies, basically to subsidize things like, you know, building out to the guy who lives on Mount Denali, like, you know, to these really high cost and rural areas, and to encourage provision of phone service at this point to things like elementary schools and libraries. Now, they did actually expand the universal service. They're expanding parts of the universal service program to broadband. That is actually going on right now. They just issued an order about a couple weeks ago for the Lifeline program. And the Lifeline program is a subsidy for low-income consumers to get phones. It started in the Reagan administration, where you could use it to pay for the cost of getting home phone service to your home. It was expanded during second Bush administration, right after Hurricane Katrina, to cover cell phones. It is now expanded to also cover broadband home connections. And weirdly enough, despite the fact this program started in the Reagan era and was expanded during Bush 2, it is now being referred to as Obama phone, for reasons that are just sadly very transparent. But essentially, there is a movement to expand that. So some programs in the Universal Service Fund have been expanded to include broadband pretty explicitly. They're going through them one by one, and it's a little bit of a piecemeal process right now. But I would not be surprised if in the future all of the like high cost and rural subsidy funds get expanded to broadband.
But is that pertinent to Title II's entry?
That's partly in Title II. So the Universal Service is a Title II program. So.
Service across all, or is it universal service telephone, universal service broadband?
There's different, so it's essentially, there's different pots of money. It's a very complicated program, but there's different programs within universal service. That's just a big umbrella term.
So we have,
yes.
There's an irritating ISP practice in which they respond to bogus DNS requests with the address for their own search site instead of returning NX domain. Is there any chance that these new rules will kill that practice? And if not, what are the GPS coordinates of the people responsible for it?
12th Street Southeast? Washington, I spend way too much time there, I should know this. I don't know.
I hope so.
Yes.
T-Mobile does that. If there's a you know no response, they give me I get a T-Mobile page, with a bunch of advertisements and suggested searches and it's.
Yeah, I think I got it from Charter.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if that gets addressed, but I haven't heard anything about it.
So Kit had mentioned earlier about new applications coming on board, and if you think back 5-10 years. You know, we typically had, you know, a handful of IP addresses in our house, right? So however number of PCs you've got. But with the Internet of Things and creating all these new sensors, and if you think about how many, you know, if you've got a smart TV, your phones, your iPads, et cetera, has the FCC and the board given any consideration of making sure that not just the new applications, but the sheer proliferation of all the devices on making sure that, you know, we're not going to overwhelm or they're not going to be discriminated against with what's going to be, if you look at, for instance, Cisco's, you know, they're saying this is going to be exponential in growth.
I think, so the open internet order addresses that in the sense that discrimination with respect to the device that is using the internet connection is something that is covered. So they thought of that. They said, no, you can't discriminate on that basis. You just have to treat it like internet traffic. Aside from that, I think the FTC has done a little bit of thinking about Internet of Things, but I'm not sure if there may be a white paper or something along those lines. I'm not sure that the FCC is discussing it in particular, though maybe Meredith would know better.
So it comes up a little bit again, and this is just bringing it back to the CPNI discussion. There's questions about, like, you know, the privacy of your data. Basically, at what point does this, like, purely administrative high-level data that doesn't look at your content actually end up reflecting your content? So, like, you know, if I get on from my home and I live in a one-person apartment, I'm the only person using my internet, and then, you know, I go to a website that, you know, has a certain ISP, and surprise, the only service at that ISP is something incriminating, like, yeah, you functionally know everything, or the only thing at that IP address. So there is a degree to which it reveals probably more than a lot of people think it does. I know Congress has been having hearings on the Internet of Things. One of my coworkers just testified there recently. We presented the nightmare scenario again, because that's what we do. It's totally plausible to think that, you know, there might be these kinds of very subtle discriminations. But having said that, under the open internet order, which is the net neutrality decision, basically, that says we are doing this, that is covered. But, you know, it would shock me if we didn't see this kind of stuff happening anyway, and we'd have to go fight it bit by bit.
See, here's the thing, though. Again, I think this is one of those things that we're going to have to come revisit as time comes on, because the reality is right now, it makes sense to treat all devices equally, because I want to make sure that when I'm sitting on my laptop, and my wife's on a desktop, and my kid's on a tablet, and I want my phone, I want to make sure they're all working, you know, on a same functional speed. At the same time, as we do get to a point where there's a consideration of how many things are on that network, I want my tablet and phone to work a whole lot faster than your smart toaster. So, you know, there may be a point where we have to come revisit this, because right now we don't have a lot of
you know, web-enabled fridges and web-enabled stoves, but they're out there, they're buying, people are selling them, and sooner or later, you're going to get to a point where there is so much content. Hopefully our ability to control that content grows faster than the devices using that content, but if it does become an issue, I think there comes a point where you say, I want my computer to work better than my fridge.
Right, and if you are configuring your home automation hub to do that, then that's no problem at all. It's just if Comcast makes that choice for you, and then your Comcast TV works faster than your competing TV, that's a problem.
I would recommend for anyone who's really interested in Internet of Things and cybersecurity, there's a wonderful talk that, I don't remember the name of the guy who gave it, it was at the Norwegian Developers Conference, and they had a post about it on Boing Boing a couple months ago. And it's a half-hour talk in which he basically says the Internet of Things is insane, and we're giving IP addresses to light bulbs, literally. And who thought this was a good idea? And we're all doomed. And it's very bleak, but it is hysterical. So I highly recommend it.
Hysterically bleak.
Yes.
Where's the cube?
I've got it here. I think this is, again, something that Kit might have said earlier on. So the encouragement of the municipality-based type internet, how do you guys see keeping that really as fair a competition when they have the power of compulsion?
So there are two modes of municipal broadband that get talked about. The one that I mentioned is sometimes called dark fiber, because you have the municipality lay in a bunch of infrastructure, and then they don't run your ISP. They open it up for the free market to compete, but they've removed the barrier to entry. So now it's possible to have a vibrant competition in the market for providing internet service, and there are some great success stories out of like Stockholm and other places where this has been done. The other model, which has been done in Chattanooga and some other places, has the town is your ISP, and you get your internet bill along with your municipal water or electric or whatever. And that's something that we're a little more lukewarm on, because we do a huge amount of privacy work, and the idea of the government also being your ISP is something that concerns us, even if there are a lot of benefits in terms of access to knowledge and cheap internet. So maybe some of my fellow panelists would like to express a different view on that.
Nope.
One thing to watch is anytime the folks are using the term metadata, check very carefully at what's going on there. Like Meredith was saying, it's scary how much data they can get from you on any particular thing. For example, now metadata is supposed to be sort of who you record, the number you're recording, the number you're going to, and that's it, not actually anything in the content itself. But if you're calling a rape crisis hotline, or if you're calling a suicide hotline, it doesn't really matter what you said. They know why you're calling those folks. And the fact that it's you calling, especially if you're like a single person in the house, it's not too hard to figure out who was calling, and you know, you can see how long you're speaking for, this kind of thing. So metadata being a cover is really untrue in many, many cases. So anytime they start saying, oh, we're just getting metadata, don't worry about it, just bear in mind that your metadata still reveals a whole lot of information that you may not want them to know, even if it's not giving them the actual content of what you were talking about.
And then remember how much you're voluntarily giving away on Facebook, and don't worry about it.
God, we're so bad.
In concerns to the Title II classification, as far as like, with that interacting with consumers getting broadband internet and such, I wanted to discuss, just for discussion purposes, I remember in the past year, year and a half, I was reading a case where I believe it was the mayor of New York had set up an agreement with Verizon Fios, and it was going horribly. Like, they had paid out maybe millions or billions of dollars, and nothing was getting done. And I don't remember how that turned out. I don't know if I read into it. And I was wondering if you guys had any input on that situation.
Yeah, so that actually, that just came down. It was even more recently than last year. It was the last couple months. So if you think about the logistical challenges of ripping up a street and putting in trunks of fiber, like, it's, especially in a very densely populated area like New York, like, it is a logistical nightmare. And there's a lot of permitting involved, there's a lot of coordinating with the city, and so essentially New York signed a contract with Verizon. Verizon said, we will pass, this is the problem, they said, we will pass X number of homes with this fiber. And the idea is that Like, you are only, your broad, or your internet connection is only as fast as your slowest part. So in most places, like, we still have, I think my apartment is like this, we just still have the copper wire that runs from inside my apartment until, and then the question is, how far does that run outside of your apartment? Does it have to run just to the curb? Does it just have to run to the basement? Does it have to run half a mile down the road? Like, that's when you start getting into really, like, sort of abysmal phone service or broadband service. And essentially, Verizon said, yes, we will pass however many million homes. And they passed less than that, and they passed it farther away than they said they would. And so right now they're in a battle about the contract and basically how they read the contract, and Verizon saying, well, we actually exceeded what we, you know, committed to doing, and New York's going, what? So that's where that comes from. And they're still fighting that out as far as I know.
Speaking of competition, I live in a place where, like, Comcast is our worst provider except for all the other ones. And
I remember that line.
Yeah, right. In my state, they had a deal with Fios. Verizon gave them a bunch of tax breaks to run internet to basically the entire state. And they were supposed to be 50% done by 2014, and they're more like 0% done. So I'm wondering, you know, is there going to be any kind of recourse to even hold a company accountable if you go to, say, dark fiber municipal broadband? You know, how are you going to hold the companies that move into that accountable if not by the government?
You probably can't hold the company. You cannot hold the company accountable because the contract isn't with you. What you can do, though, and politicians are very big on this, is organize protests against whoever was in office when that deal was made. Basically tell them, look, if you don't fix this, we're voting you out. And get enough signatures behind you that it becomes a real threat. At that point, they'll start fighting that battle of, well, you guys said you're going to do this and you didn't do this, what's up with that? But in some ways that's useful, in other ways it's not, because it gives you an extra level of what you have to go to. But again, with it being the government, you, in many ways, you actually have a lot more hold over them than over private companies, simply because their lawyers are probably better than the ones you can afford. Whereas if they go up against the government, they're not only risking that particular contract, but they may be risking future contracts with the government as well. So in a case like that, I would definitely go to your local representatives, bring it up to them, and don't just go to your particular one. Go through as many levels as you can get hold of and file complaints with each one. And if they do nothing, then start organizing issues against the particular politician who's not doing anything, and that usually tends to light a fire under them.
State regulatory commissions are also sort of, your mileage may vary depending on what state you're in. The New York Public Utility Commission is actually, like, wonderful as far as public utility commissions go. A lot of states have been, in the last 20 years or so, really rapidly deregulating phone and internet access, like, to the point where they've put some, you know, laws in the book saying you may not regulate phone companies or internet service providers. This is a problem. But again, depending on where you live, you know, definitely check with your state public utility commission and, you know, like Jeff said, just run it up the flagpole.
Yeah, and in the dark fiber context, once the infrastructure is built, the ISPs have a lot less power because they don't have a sort of monopoly on infrastructure. So the place where you would have this concern is with whoever you're contracting with to get the fiber built out in the first place. And one of the things that a couple of cities have been doing that seems like a really good idea is, because digging up your streets is expensive, whenever you're doing it for sewer maintenance or power maintenance or whatever, just lay some fiber in there, because that's going to be a really high bandwidth technology for a long time. You won't have to dig up the street again to lay it in, and then over time you can start to build up this network, and then when you reach a critical mass, open it up. And even if it's not an end-to-end link, it can be an intermediate link where I have my private network that gets me to the public fiber, then I lease bandwidth on the public fiber network, and that hooks up to the rest of my network. And even if it's not an end-to-end connection, it reduces the barrier to entry for new ISPs to compete with the incumbents.
And that's part of the reason, if you've ever looked at, like, the Fios map, and I live in Washington, D.C., and it's just indecipherably bizarre. It's like a Jackson Pollock painting. It's just, there's no rhyme or reason, and that's part of the reason why, is because they sort of do this piecemeal layout.
Concerning the metadata conversation earlier, if you're comfortable tunneling or proxy chaining, Can the ISPs be able to throttle based on that solely for that metadata capture?
Well, they can, but they shouldn't, because again, that goes back to being network neutral. The good thing is obviously they can't spy on what your metadata is as far as that goes, other than you're opening a connection between point A and point B. But Tor network is really good for that. And if they start throttling that, you should see that pretty quickly. And EFF will get on that one real fast if they start throttling Tor. But same thing, you know, compare your speed going through a couple different VPNs, you know, use their 30-day or 15-day free thing and see if your speeds do change. If it's a ISP level block, you'll probably get the same degradation throughout all the services. If it's specific to, you know, this particular VPN service is overloaded, you'll only get then the drop on that particular one. But no, as far as network neutrality goes, they should be treating that just like anything else.
So I know several of the ISPs will monitor traffic and sometimes inject things into people's web pages to notify them that they have a bot installed on their computer, their machine is infected. What are your opinions on ISPs using technology basically to protect their network from hostile activity?
In general, I'd say it's a good idea in theory. Because obviously, if my neighbor's running a bot network unknowingly next to me, it's going to affect my service, and I want to do something about that. If I'm purposely running a bot network, then yeah, you know, they're going to come down on me hard, and they should, as far as that goes. So in principle, I think it's a good idea. Now, the implementation of it could be a whole different thing. If for no other reason that the algorithms that determine whether you are running a bot network or not may not be up to snuff. You know, they may be getting a whole bunch of false positives. But certainly the idea is not a bad idea.
Yeah, and this also ties back to, reaching even further back to when you had to rent your telephone. Back when you were not allowed to buy your own telephone and you had to rent one from the phone company. This was before my time. I'm sad to admit how young I am here. But yeah, it was under the guise of, well, we don't know if we haven't approved it as the phone. This is AT&T basically going, well, we haven't approved it, so we don't know if it might be bad for our network. And the problem is we're a little afraid that we might start seeing the same arguments again. This kind and applied to all kinds of traffic that, you know, and functionally, like, eventually the FCC said, no, this is nonsense. Like, you have to allow these new phones to connect into your network unless you actively know that they're damaging it somehow. And so we're, you know, it would not shock me if we start seeing those kinds of arguments again about different kinds of software interconnection saying like, oh no, we need to be able to block these because they harm our network. And that's where you get into a debate about what constitutes a reasonable network management practice, which is something that they are allowed to do under the Open Internet Order. And that's, you know, we're going to be litigating and relitigating that until the cows come home.
Right. It's one thing if the network is under attack for them to take steps to mitigate it. It's another thing for them to do deep packet inspection on all your internet traffic to see if you might be sending, you know, malware somewhere else or any other, performing any other unlawful activity. Like, we would not want your ISP to be doing DPI on a phishing expedition to find unlawful content.
How about the peace response? Any of this? Can you hear me?
And the battery's going on shock box.
How are I responding to this already in opponents? And you know, are they going to be able to do anything to undo? And is there any positive things that have already come from Title II, like peering negotiations and things like that?
So I can't speak to the business side, but it is in court right now. We're in the very first stage of a lawsuit from the ISPs against the FCC. EFF, I think, you guys are filing an amicus brief.
We will be supporting the order.
And public knowledge, we're an intervener, so we have like a slightly different rule set. But essentially, like, yeah, this is at the district court. It will, whatever the decision is, it will probably be appealed. This is going to be in court for a long time, a couple years. So, you know, right now, essentially, the ISPs are arguing that the FCC doesn't have authority to reclassify them, that Congress never envisioned for broadband to be classified as a Title II service. They're getting into some free speech arguments, which are really spurious about, like, oh, well, we're a network manager, so we're a speaker, and no. You know, just because you own a telephone line doesn't mean you're doing the talking. So, yeah, it's ongoing, and it'll be going on for quite some time. Some side effects have been pretty good. There's been a lot more scrutiny on the network practices, so things like throttling. There's things... So, again, going back to CPNI, I apologize for harping on this, but it's something I've been working a lot on recently. So a lot of concern we have for a company like AT&T. AT&T came out straight up and said, part of the reason that we are opposed to this is because right now we take all this CPNI from our broadband users and we give it to other companies that are also partly owned by us, and we use it for marketing purposes. Now, under the Telecommunications Act, if you have CPNI, and you're, like, if you're a phone company and you get CPNI, you cannot sell that to other people. You cannot use it for anything other than providing these people the service that they are paying you to provide. And right now, AT&T straight up admitted in an affidavit, like, yeah, we take this, and then we have a home alarm system, and we send it to the people who manage our home alarm system, and then we market to the customers for this. They are currently fighting this one too, but they said straight up, like, they sort of admitted, like, that they've stopped, but they haven't quite committed to it. So it's starting, because this is all new, we're still trying to, like, it's playing whack-a-mole right now, but there have been some good side effects.
And in other things that could undermine the order, it would be possible for Congress to act to undermine it. It seems like it's unlikely. And also, if we get a Republican president, then the FCC will switch to having a majority Republican commissioners, and they could also act to reverse what this FCC has done.
They're very not fond of the order.
Do you foresee that the FCC will do a lot of quality control? If I purchase, you know, internet at this speed and I get it at Comcast speed instead of what I bought?
That's definitely they will have the power to address to take consumer complaints about network quality, and then that gets into a false advertising thing too, which is more the FTC. That's certainly within their purview.
I wanted to go back to what we were talking about earlier with the Internet of Things. I know that the IPv6 is being developed to address the issue of the Internet of Things, and I was wondering what the difference in how IPv6 is set up as, you know, 32-bit versus 16-bit IP address. Does the difference in the IP address structure affect how it's routed, and does that have a different impact on how traffic could be affected, you know, as far as net neutrality goes?
It can, but it shouldn't. For the most part, everything that connects in your house usually connects to the ISP through a single IP address. So we don't really need IPv6 addresses there yet. But that being said, some of the more modern routers, you will see IPv4 and IPv6 address. The naming, like you said, the naming convention there is pretty much just to get more IP address space available. What it's doing with that shouldn't really make much of a difference. That being said, because it is different, yes, they can route on that differently, but that I know of so far, no one's yet done it because the IPv6 has not become that prolific yet. Mostly it's still being used sort of within companies themselves. You are starting to see it on the internet, but it obviously it's not nearly as advanced as the IPv4 stuff is. And we probably won't see it for too much longer sort of at the consumer level, simply because most folks are still connecting through a single point to their ISP, and your router's taking care of all of your back-end addresses, and your IPv4 is still good enough to send you through to the to your ISP from there.
Yeah, this is Scott. I wanted to address the IPv6 question as an application developer. What you'll see that a lot of times today, like the underlying operating systems like Windows and Linux, they can speak IPv6 in this day and age. And the routers, many routers can speak IPv6 unless they're older. But a lot of times you see that applications are not quite IPv6 ready, or perhaps they did some cursory integration of IPv6, but they haven't really kind of done it all the way. So you'll see things that may break. And, you know, sometimes you may come out, if you're using an IPv6 address, sometimes you may win sometimes and you may lose sometimes. But just because your packets are being discriminated against, or they look like they're being discriminated against with an IPv6 address, it's not necessarily a policy on the part of the ISP at that point. It may be a broken application, or it may be anywhere in the stack, in the OSI stack, there could be some breakage. So IPv6 has been around a while, and it's been a settled standard for a while, but it takes a long time for all the changes to bubble up all the way through the application layer, and I think that when you see discrimination based on that, you're seeing more breakage than any particular policy change, because it really should be, the bits should still be the bits, and the addressing is all that's changed, but not everybody's really kind of, not everybody's really adjusted their code to handle all the edge cases and all the possibilities with V6. Okay, well, we're going to have to wrap up pretty soon. Let's see.
3:30?
Right. Well, all right. That's time then.
Yeah, thanks to everyone for coming over.